Tonight's lesson comes from the Gospel of Luke, the 24th chapter, verses 13 through 35. That very day, two of them were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all the things that had happened while they were talking and discussing together. Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What is the conversation which you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty indeed in word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since this happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning and did not find his body. And they came back saying that they had seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the woman had said, but him they did not see. And he said to them, 'O foolish men and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. What was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So they drew near to the village in which they were going. He appeared to be going further, but they constrained him, saying, 'Stay with us, for it's toward evening, and the day is now far spent.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight. They said to each other, 'Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scripture?' And they rose the same hour and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 gathered together, and those who were with them, who said, 'The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon.' Then they told what had happened on the road, and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread." The word of the Lord.
So I'm driving down here last Sunday, Easter afternoon, and I have over an hour's drive. And the morning's been kind of a little bit hectic with all the pagan rituals, which I like, all that fertility symbolism. I like the idea of fertile bunnies mating and mating and making extravagant numbers of eggs so profuse that they are left all over the place for children to find. And Easter baskets, which I usually like, but actually this year they made me feel horrible because I filled them with all the stuff I bought from the Easter aisles at Target, breaking my pledge not to consume. And somehow plastic and pastel-colored starbursts and My Little Ponies with bunny ears misses all the natural pagan fertility earthiness of Easter and anything Christianity might contribute. But anyway, so in the car on my trip down, it's my first quiet moment alone. And I really wanted to try and sort of, I don't know, absorb or at least think about the profundity of what the church proclaims at Easter. It's the biggest day of the church year. Without Easter, there wouldn't be Christianity. But it just wasn't really working for me. I kept trying to keep my mind on the resurrection, but it kept attaching itself to other things, like the shame of being a consumer drone, like all the cars that were surrounding me. Why, I wondered, is there so much traffic on Easter afternoon? Is everyone coming home from church? No, it's too late for that. They're probably going back and forth between relatives where they've eaten ham and jelly beans. And why do we eat ham on Easter? Is it just to offend the Jewish tradition, people of other faiths who don't eat pig? And why did we invent cars? And why are people trying to go places all the time? I could hardly keep my mind focused on the resurrection for 1 minute. I thought about how weird humans are. Like, we think we act on our own volition. We have independent minds, and we think we have some sort of special sort of consciousness that makes us transcend animals, but we're obviously such animals. Such unconscious, habitual, market-obeying, foil, egg, plastic, grass-buying, ham-eating, car-driving animals. Weird animals. Not more conscious, really, than dogs or frogs or bunnies, fetching and copulating and shopping. Some genes more fit than others to survive in the world, to preserve the species. Somehow I wasn't really feeling the Easter spirit. Christ is risen seemed vaguely irrelevant, like something I was trying to work up some feeling about, but something that if you look at it in the face is, well, I don't know, mostly a little hard to believe. These are the most holy days, the Easter season, and also a little bit the most embarrassing. It almost seems like you can make the resurrection seem good and hopeful more by talking around it or making it pagan, all about spring and chirping birds, rather than pronouncing it head on. A person who was murdered on Friday rose from the dead on Sunday. That is the absolutely crucial center of the Christian witness. And it just seems a little weird and a lot unscientific. And somehow more complicated than sweet and fuzzy humping bunnies. It's the revelation, the event that changes everything. And you can hardly even see it clearly enough to focus on it for 2 minutes. That's an odd kind of thing to have as the absolutely crucial center of a faith. My Sunday school teachers used to say that because of Easter, I didn't have to be afraid to die. Which seemed sort of nice when I was 7 or 13, but it's not nearly enough. Some personal assurance that you can take out at night or once in a while. This is supposed to change the world. So it's Easter afternoon, and these two people who haven't actually appeared anywhere else in Luke's story, one has a name we've never heard before, and the other isn't named, Cleopas and X. Anyway, these two people are walking down the road to Emmaus, a place that people have tried to identify, but it doesn't actually seem like there really was an Emmaus. So they are two unknown people heading off to a place that doesn't exist. And this is where and to whom the resurrected Jesus makes his first appearance. Seems a little bit like an odd choice. The two people are very sad and disoriented or confused, maybe. They had apparently really believed that Jesus was going to do a lot of things, like change the world. And then he was just killed by the government that he was supposed to overthrow and killed by the religion he was supposed to reform. Somehow that seems like a familiar scenario to me. Jesus being destroyed by the forces he was supposed to overcome. Like when you walk into Northwestern Bookstore and you see his image plastered all over the merchandise. Some sentimental rendition in plastic or praise songs embalmed in the irrelevant and the trite. The subversive revolutionary made into a peddler for someone's religious system. Seems like he's been sold out and strung up endlessly. Or when you live in an empire that makes war, thrives on capital, and an enormous dirty machine that claims his name, a Christian nation. Seems pretty much like he's been co-opted always by the forces he was supposed to undo. The people on the road are in the midst of talking about what it means that Jesus was destroyed. When Jesus, who they don't recognize, comes up and starts walking with them and asks them what they are talking about. What are they talking about? It's like he doesn't even know what they're talking about. Their interpretation is so different than his own. It seems like kind of a beautiful moment, maybe for the obvious reasons. He may have been sealed in rock or plastic or false rhetoric, but they weren't able to keep him dead. But it's also such a strange scenario that it's hard to absorb. I mean, of course, the idea that a dead person is alive again, an not like a ghost, which is weird enough, but actually less weird than the real live body and brain and voice of someone who has been in the grave for a day and two nights, walking around and asking questions. Within 24 hours, bacteria, fungi, insects, mammalian scavengers begin to eat a dead body. Blood becomes uncoagulable, unable to clot, and it pools in the lowest parts of the corpse. Maybe being dead for a day and two nights is the kind of thing that might change a person enough that they'd be hard to recognize. This isn't a story about someone who wasn't really touched by death, appearing unscathed. This is a body that has actually been dead and is now alive. It's just more strange and weird and intense than a story about a soul that never dies. So the two people are talking about the murder, and Jesus asks, "What are you talking about?" And so they start to tell him their version. And eventually he's like, "Wait, whoa, you've got it all wrong." And this is a pretty weird thing too. Usually it's the people who aren't dead who tell the stories, who interpret the situation. This is the dead guy coming back to interpret for them. It's obviously a story that someone might have made up, but say they didn't. Beyond the facts or whatever that are hard to believe, it's hard to believe what the dead guy does. This is a murder victim, and not the victim of a random murder. This is like a victim of a sort of systematic torture. Someone accused wrongly of a crime and then tortured to death by the greatest powers that be. The guy telling the story was punished to death for no wrong just 2 days before by the Roman Empire and the religious authorities and abandoned by all his friends. It seems like his version of the story might, I don't know, have a little anger behind it. A little righteous indignation, a little urgent sort of drama. Let's just say you believed an unjustly crucified dead man might walk and talk. It's surprising what this one does. And I think a little bit unsettling. I mean, say there was a very kind shopkeeper in Iraq who loved his friends and all the people around him, who was known for inviting hungry strangers into his house and giving them soup. And though he was poor himself, he was always caring and giving to the poor. And then someone who had something against him for some reason, or someone who wanted his business, turns him into the United States military. Maybe they want the reward that the Army's offering for anyone suspected of being related to terrorism. And the poor, kind shopkeeper gets taken to Abu Ghraib, and he gets interrogated, and he gets stripped naked and humiliated and mocked and tortured to death at the hands of the military. And then say this guy came back alive 2 days later. I would, I think, kind of hope that he might do something a little bit dramatic, maybe, to expose the corruption and the injustice, like maybe go directly to President Bush or Pat Robertson or Fox News. I think I'd want him to name names. Make sure the guilty ones got prosecuted. Want him to give evidence that might somehow stop the war in Iraq or at least the military's practice of unjust victimization. Make some scene, at least. Just a little different than taking a walk with two unknown people on a road going nowhere. And they don't recognize him. And he doesn't say, "Hey, look, it's me. Come on, let's go get the evil perpetrators of injustice." What he does do, of all things he might have done, is he opens the scriptures for them. That could seem a little bit like, come on. Sort of irresponsible, a waste of time. Or maybe it's like the risen victim takes the script that people were using as their operating manual, the stories that everyone told about God, the ideas that structured the world, the rules that people followed and thought God invented, the structures people clung to, and he shakes it all out and says, "Look, it's not what you thought." He makes them see what they've looked at 1,000 times and never seen. It's a little bit frustrating here that it just says he showed them. And it doesn't give us the content of what he showed them. It doesn't give us any words for what it looked like. It doesn't give us a revised script. Maybe because the words would inevitably be so paltry. Maybe because the content is really all right there in him. A God who doesn't come seeking vengeance for wrong. That's actually sort of astonishing, given what we generally believe about the principles that order and structure the universe. Incredible. The risen victim so clearly doesn't come back to punish the wicked and reward the good. The disciples kind of wanted the evil empire overthrown. The history of Israel, the faith, had a lot to do with a hope for a time when the good and the faithful would finally win the day. Jesus coming back like he does, acting like he does, strolling down the road with two nobodies after he's been murdered by the faithless and the faithful and betrayed by his friends, somehow makes clear it's not about God versus the evil people, the good people versus the bad people. To tell the truth, there weren't really any good people in the story of his crucifixion. No heroes or innocents, no characters whose exemplary behavior we might like to cling. Jesus says to the two people on the road, "Can't you see that this had to happen? How it was necessary? What's the good news of great joy for all people? Every single man, woman, and child, everybody, everywhere, the whole earth. It's not be good. It's not survival of the fittest. It has something to do with God, the creative lover of the world, being willing to die for God's children at their hands, and then coming back alive again like, hey, I'm not going away, never being done with them. Coming back not to make them pay, but to give them some more love. Unstoppable, transformative, scandalous love for all people, mercy for all people. Not you get what you deserve, but you get love." Later, the people on the road realized how their hearts burned within them when Jesus revealed this to him. And it changes everything. Instead of telling the story they would have told, how good triumphs over evil and the bad people get punished, they tell a completely different story. The disciples go on to preach the gospel of the grace of God. Instead of telling the story they might have told, a story to draw the line once and for all between the good and the bad, how the victim got revenge, who knows, they preach the mercy. Unconditional, utterly gratuitous love, a love that loves the merchandisers, the traders, the suffocators, the consumer droves. Likes them, actually. Seeks desperately and insatiably for communion with them. It is an embarrassingly unfettered, unguarded, ridiculously fertile, copious yes. So the two people on the road have the script turned inside out. Their hearts burn, but they still don't recognize Jesus. But even so, they invite him to dinner. And he sits at the table and he breaks the bread and he gives it to them. And then in that moment, they finally recognize him. He hands himself over to them, gives them no words but pieces of himself. He gives his body and blood to the people he loves. He puts himself in their hands. It seems risky and vulnerable. What they do with it, he's not really trying to control. It's when he hands himself over that they recognize him. And in that moment, he disappears. Jesus is like, "Here, take this. Have your minds and your hearts and your imaginations transformed by the resurrection. You maybe can't focus on it or see it even exactly. But here, take a piece of me into your mouth and taste it."